Hello, everyone, and welcome to Awakening the Impulse to Evolve. My name is Claire Zammit, and in addition to being one of the presenters in the series, I'm also on the board of Integral Enlightenment, the organization that's producing this event. I'm delighted to have you with us for week two of our series featuring Michael Dowd. I'd like to extend a special welcome to those of you who are joining us for the first time tonight. It's great to have you with us, and we look forward to getting to know as many of you as possible throughout the series. It's been so inspiring to see the groundswell of enthusiasm and interest for this event continuing to surge across the Internet this past week. We now have over 28,000 people registered in the series worldwide, and our community is growing every day. In recognition of the scale of this global community, many of you have asked about ways to connect more intimately and explore your topics of interest with each other. We have two dynamic programs to help you connect and begin to build this global evolutionary community. The first and easiest way to engage with each other is to join our new Facebook group. Join us there to meet evolutionaries from around the world and engage in ongoing discussions about all the topics we'll be exploring in the series. Just click on the Facebook icon in the email we sent you today, or go to Facebook and search for Awakening the Impulse to Evolve. The second way we've come up with for you to interact with each other is our virtual evolutionary cafe. Each week following the teleseminar, you'll have the opportunity to come together with a small group of fellow evolutionaries in a facilitated conference call environment to explore different topics that we have been discussing on the calls. We'll be using the new revolutionary Maestro conference technology for this, which we also use for all of our courses and events. It allows us to break you up into small groups, much like a workshop environment where we ask a question and then guide a group inquiry. To participate in the cafe, you'll need to create a personalized PIN code and register for that call separately. You can find instructions about how to participate in tonight's Evolutionary Cafe in the email that we sent you this afternoon. But before we begin, just a couple of notes that I'd like to share. First, many of you have been requesting a schedule for all of the events, so I want to let you know that we'll be soon posting a full schedule on the website. We're still nailing down a couple of dates with the presenters, but we'll send you a link to that schedule as soon as we have it so you can plan your participation accordingly. Secondly, we know you won't always be able to participate live, so we'll also be posting the audios to the events on a single page where you can easily access them and download to listen at your convenience. You can find the link to the archives page in the email we sent you yesterday morning. So the way the event's going to work this evening is Integral Enlightenment founder Craig Hamilton will introduce Michael Dowd and the day's topic. Then he and Michael will dialogue for about an hour. Then Michael will spend about half an hour taking your questions. If you have a question for Michael, simply send it to us in your instant message window, in the teleseminar window on your computer, or dial into the conference line and press star 2 to let us know that you have a question. Before we begin, I'd just like to take a moment to introduce you to Integral Enlightenment founder Craig Hamilton, who's the visionary behind this groundbreaking series. Craig is a contemporary mystic and pioneer in the emerging field of evolutionary spirituality. In his work at Integral Enlightenment, Craig integrates decades of intensive spiritual practice with insights gleaned during his 8 years as senior editor of the award-winning What is Enlightenment magazine. Through his writings and teachings, he is helping to articulate an authentic evolutionary mysticism and integral enlightenment, which illuminates the vital relationship between individual transformation and collective evolution. Craig is a founding member of Ken Wilber's Integral Institute and a participant in the Synthesis Dialogues, the 35-person interdisciplinary think tank presided over by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Craig lives and teaches in Berkeley, California, where he offers instruction and guidance in evolutionary spiritual practice to students from around the world through a series of online courses and seminars. For anyone who's interested, he's also offering a telecourse on Integral Enlightenment starting next week. So welcome, Craig, and I know I speak for all of us when we say how much we're looking forward to your dialogue with Michael this evening.
Thank you, Claire. It's always a pleasure. Hi, everyone. And thank you for all of your kind comments about the series introduction that we had last week. It was great to step back and take in the big picture, and always a pleasure to speak with Carter Phipps. I hope you enjoyed the history lesson, and if you didn't, don't worry, that will probably be the only history lesson that you'll get in this series. So, anyway, I'm delighted to have you with us for week two in our series featuring my very good friend and colleague, Michael Dowd. For those of you who don't know Michael, he's the author of the best-selling book, Thank God for Evolution, How the Marriage of Science and Religion Will Transform Your Life and Our World. The book has been endorsed by 6 Nobel laureates, other science luminaries, including even noted skeptics, as well as religious leaders across the spectrum. Michael and his wife, Connie Barlow, who's an acclaimed science writer, have spoken to more than 1,000 groups since launching their itinerant ministry in 2002. They're at home in both liberal and conservative settings and uniquely gifted at building bridges between religious and non-religious people. Michael shares the epic of evolution, our common creation story, in ways that uplift and expand the heart, the mind, and the soul. And his passion is really showing how a deep time understanding of human nature can inspire and empower each of us to live our lives with greater integrity, joy, and zest for life. What his bio doesn't tell you in detail is what that itinerant ministry is all about, but Michael and his wife, Connie, for the past, I don't know, I need to get the number from you, Michael, but I think probably, what, about 8 years, past 8 years, yeah, okay, have been, they just have been on a mission roaming around the country from one town to the next and evangelizing about the great story of evolution and its implications for how we live and for spirituality. And they're really doing something that I don't know anybody else who's doing, which is just the way they've taken it to the road, living kind of a contemporary homeless life in a sense, staying in different people's homes as they travel along. And it's just been a kind of beautiful expression of you know, two people joined together in a higher mission. So they have lived a very interesting life. I'm sure we'll get some tidbits about that as well. Michael and I first met about 8 years ago, in fact, when he spoke at my parents' Unitarian church. And my mom came up to him afterward and said something like, "You sound a lot like my son, and you two should meet." And this was back when I was editor of What is Enlightenment magazine, and so she connected us by email, and then I invited Michael and Connie to visit us at the Enlighten Next World Center in Massachusetts, where I was living at the time. And since then, we've had many opportunities to spend time together over the years pondering the great mysteries of evolutionary spirituality. So it's great to be back with you, Michael. Welcome to Awakening the Impulse to Evolve.
Thank you, Craig. It's a delight to be here.
Likewise. So just to tee this up a bit, the big question that we're exploring in this series is, how does our newfound understanding of evolution, this relatively recent realization that we're evolving creatures living in an evolving cosmos, how does that transform the spiritual path? As we talked about last week, all the great wisdom traditions of the world came into being at a time when humanity knew nothing about evolution. And it's probably hard for most of us to relate to this now, but we have to remember this idea of evolution is really a brand new concept, only started to emerge a couple hundred years ago and really only entered the public eye fully with Darwin's work about 150 years ago. So we're just beginning to catch up with the implications of this. And, you know, now we're seeing we emerged out of this cosmic evolutionary unfolding. We didn't just appear. We weren't just created. And so we're starting to ask, how does this understanding change our relationship to being alive? And particularly in this context, how does it change our understanding of the spiritual path and goal? And so you and I have a specific agenda tonight, which is to talk about evolutionizing our lives, what you call cultivating big integrity. But before we get there, I'm wondering if you could just share some of your broader reflections on the context I just laid out. How does evolution change the way we approach and understand spirituality and our place in the cosmos?
Yeah, great question. I can tell you how it's done it for me and for many people I've spoken to. Many people think about evolution as, you know, Darwin and DNA and dinosaurs and things like that. And really, the way that Connie and I speak about evolution is what we're talking about is the history of everyone and everything. It's also called big history. It's the universe story or the epic of evolution. It's the 14 billion year history of cosmos, earth, life, and humanity as our common creation story, as humanity's common sacred story that helps us answer the fundamental questions that human beings have always had, like who are we? Where did we come from? Why are we here? Where are we going? You know, how are we to live? These core questions that are core to every culture at all times, ever since we've had language, we now have a way of answering these questions that aren't merely belief-based but are knowledge-based, and that knowledge can help us really grow into a wisdom, a worldwide wisdom, so that we can move forward in a healthy way and cooperate across ethnic and religious differences. So for me, the main thing it's done in terms of how this epic of evolution has reframed the whole understanding of spirituality is that it's made it really practical. In other words, we now have some real measurable evidence that our and I see science as our collective intelligence. It's the worldwide self-correcting enterprise of helping us to distinguish objective and subjective reality and helping us to make sense of religious differences and this sort of thing. And for me, it has given me a sense of who I am. I'm the universe, that we all are the universe becoming conscious of itself. Like, that's who we are in our deepest essence. We are life becoming aware of itself. We're the holy, if you will, becoming manifest in and through matter and energy. And so that sense of identification that I am related to all beings, that I'm related to all of life, and that my ancestors include the stars, like, that's incredible. I mean, kids get off on this. I mean, it's not just spirituality in a sort of ethereal sense, but in a very practical way, young people and old people alike can really find deep inspiration in this sacred understanding of the science-based history of the universe.
Mm. And you said that you were going to share a little bit about how it's done it for you. I want to actually even go there a little bit more, because you have an unusual history in that you were an evangelical Christian. You were actually in the training, I think, to be a minister, and you became a minister within that context. And I know you initially were anti-evolution for some significant period of your life, and then you had some sort of evolutionary awakening. Can you share a little bit about that journey?
Yeah, sure, be happy to. Yeah, I grew up Roman Catholic, had a born-again experience in my teenage years, actually I was 20, I think, in Berlin, Germany. And I was struggling a lot in my later teenage years with what Christians call our sinful nature, with drugs, alcohol, sexuality issues. So I was really struggling with our instincts, with my instincts that I now have an understanding through an evolutionary perspective. And at any rate, was discipled in a very fundamentalist context, went to a Christian and evangelical college, an Assemblies of God-related college in Springfield, Missouri. And ended up graduating there. It was sort of a miracle I stayed there, because I almost left. When I found out that they taught evolution at this college, I freaked, because I had by that time come to believe that evolution was of the devil and all the evils of the world could be attributed to Darwin. So I literally stormed out of class the first day I learned that they taught evolution there, went to the registrar's office and withdrew from the course. The two things that shifted me, one is that I had met a Buddhist Christian who was the most Christ-like person I'd ever met, but my theology said he was going to hell. Yet my heart said, ask him to mentor you. So it was a real personal shift. The other thing is that I came to see that evolution could be understood in a sacred, meaningful way, to use traditional religious language, in a God-honoring way. And so I ended up embracing evolution, or I can't say I embraced it. I accepted evolution at that time, but it wasn't until 1988 when I was introduced to the work of Thomas Berry and Brian Swim. And that's where I really came to embrace this understanding of the universe story as our common creation story, and that humans are the universe becoming aware of itself. So from that point on, from February 1st, 1988, I've basically spent my life immersing myself in this great story, this epic of evolution, teasing out its spiritual and psychological benefits, and teaching and preaching it to as many people as I could. I've also spent a week with Thich Nhat Hanh in 1993, I think it was, and so I've found the meditation traditions, both in the East and in the West, a deep source of inspiration and grounding, but it really wasn't until I grounded myself in evolutionary psychology and evolutionary brain science that I experienced the sort of the promises of traditional religion in this life. I mean, I was just, as you know, I was just diagnosed a few months ago with cancer, and I've been undergoing chemotherapy, and I'm actually going to be talking to a surgeon tomorrow to have my spleen removed. And I got to the place, because of this evolutionary understanding, this evolutionary spirituality, of having no secrets, no resentments, and no unfinished business, which means that if I could die, if I died tonight, I'm feeling complete with the world, and I'm pursuing where my joy and the world's needs intersect. And the combination of those two things, you know, having no secrets, no resentments, and no unfinished business, and pursuing where my joy, my gifts, and the world's needs intersect, I experience heaven now. I experience, it's amazing to be in this place of heavenly joy, peace, fulfillment, whatever, and I don't lose the awareness that I am life consciously participating in its own evolution. So it's a combination of what I've learned over the last 20 years, but more personally, this path of evolutionary spirituality, the way I see it is it's coming home to reality. It's really coming home and dwelling, abiding, relaxing in the realm of reality, the way reality really is. And it's everything to me.
Well, that's beautiful. And in terms of this last point you're making, because I know this is something that you speak a lot about. You sent me a recent blog post that you did on evolutionary spirituality, and in that you were saying that evolutionary spirituality is fundamentally about getting into right relationship with reality.
Yeah.
So maybe say a little more about what do you mean by right relationship to reality, and for that matter, what do you mean by reality? Because of course here we are in a postmodern age when the very notion that we could perceive reality accurately has been largely tossed by the wayside. We live in this time of relativism when any notion of the truth or the reality has been replaced by some idea of your truth and my truth, and we can't ever really know anything that's really true. And so I just want to push into this because I really appreciate that you're bringing reality back. I'm really trying to bring reality back too, with a capital R. So maybe share a little bit about, what you mean by that.
Sure. Well, human beings have always lived in a bioregion, lived in an area, the air, water, soil, and life of their region, and have attempted to understand the nature of reality in that place. And naturally, they did so, with a blend of subjectively meaningful language, metaphorical language, symbolic language, and in a way that really facilitated their cooperation and held them together as a tribe or as a community, as a unity. And over the course of human history, we've found ways of storing and sharing information in ever more effective ways, so that when writing comes into existence, writing emerges out of a world, an oral world, where the primary way that information is stored and shared is the stories that we tell. So the encyclopedias reside in the minds of the elders, in the stories and the rituals that the elders communicate, and that's where the life-giving wisdom that helps the tribe to thrive exists. And then in writing, we start finding this wisdom, this knowledge, these insights written down. But again, because people lived in different parts of the world, some desert climates, some mountain climates, tropical climates, all over, they used different analogies and metaphors for the nature of reality. So we find all different stories about the nature of reality, and they used what I call day and night language. Day language meaning more literal sort of everyday language, night language being the language of our dreams, of myth, of poetry. So the nature of reality was talked about in different ways in different cultures. Joseph Campbell's work, of course, has been all about this, and others working with the world religions and world mythology. And then we come to the complexification. Basically, we had so much writing and so much information that the scientific way of knowing is really worldwide. It emerged all over the world. I mean, primarily it emerged out of Europe, but it's quickly become worldwide, so that you've got atheist scientists and Jewish scientists and Christian scientists and Hindu and Chinese scientists all working together. And really what the worldwide scientific enterprise is it's humanity's collective intelligence. It's our best understandings about objective reality and what we can say meaningfully about subjective reality. But it's helped us to make sense of the various differences that we found that used to be thought of as competing, used to be thought of as at war with each other. And so coming into right relationship with reality, for example, one of the things that we know, we don't believe, is that reality is nested. It's holarchical. It's, you know, subatomic particles within atoms, within molecules, within cells, within organisms, within planets, within galaxies, like nesting dolls, like Russian nesting dolls. You know, Ken Wilber and others talk about it in terms of holons. Arthur Kessler and others refer to it as holons, nested holons. We are each holes that are also parts of larger holes that are themselves parts of larger holes. And we don't believe this. We know this. And so having a right relationship with reality means recognizing that just even to ask the question, what does it mean to be at right relationship with my bioregion, with the air, water, and soil of my region? What does it mean to be in right relationship with my intimates, my spouse, my mother, father, sister, brother, cousin, you know, the people who are close to me, my office workers, my, you know, whoever? And what does it mean to be in right relationship with the past, with the present, with the future? I mean, these are profound questions, and there's no one right answer. These are questions that emerge in conversation. They emerge as a result of the entities that are, you know, that are being discussed or involved with, asking the question, simply pondering the question, what does it mean to be in right relationship? What does integrity mean at this scale or at this level? And so I'm not meaning to, when I talk about right relationship to reality with a capital R, I'm using the word reality as a synonym, if you will, for God, for ultimacy, for, you know, everyone and everything, and the mystery within all, you know, within which it all resides and is at the heart of everything. And it's something that emerges. I'm an emergentist. It's something that emerges. There's a whole that is greater than the sum of its parts, and it's different. And so I trust that process, and I am profoundly committed to living in right relationship with reality myself and to helping to do what I can in my, you know, little spheres of influence toward helping humanity move into a right relationship with reality, ecological and evolutionary reality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And one of the areas that you brought up a little while back in the conversation, which I want to kind of drill into in terms of this kind of path question that we're talking about right now, is, you know, you brought up the whole arena of evolutionary psychology, which is really the kind of study of why we are the way we are, to quote Robert Wright's subtitle of his famous book, The Moral Animal. And I know you've really taken that inquiry and the insights of evolutionary psychology deeply to heart, starting to try to really understand, you know, this, our human psychology, our human behavior, in a sense, our human nature, all in an evolutionary context. And I think it's something we don't want to take for granted, because obviously, you know, we the notion of human nature almost implies something that's fixed. Right, like we talk about human. What's human nature? Well, it's something that's one thing. We have our bad side and we have our good side. And but where did it come from? Of course, all the old creation myths, you know, had their various stories to try to explain why we had all these, you know, better angels of our nature, the inner demons, whatever. You know, different mythologies emerged around this, trying to explain human behavior and human nature. But I know. Yeah, you've really attempted to translate that into a spiritual context and into a transformative context. Could you just speak some about, you know, how evolutionary psychology has influenced your own work, what you feel is the core insight there that can be liberating for us?
Yeah, well, great question. I think I'd start by saying that all spiritualities, all religions – have one of the main things that they've attempted to do is to help people and communities thrive in the context of three human universals, three things that are true for everyone everywhere. And that is that chaos is real, that death is real, and that we have instincts. That is, we have an unchosen nature. We have inherited proclivities. We have aspects of ourselves that we didn't choose. We just find ourselves this way. But these proclivities, this nature that we have, is sometimes at odds with our life in a modern or postmodern world. You know, in other words, our instincts evolved to serve the survival and reproduction needs of our ancestors. They didn't evolve to help us thrive in the world that we today have to live in with promises and declarations and expectations and covenants and vows and everything else, and being bombarded with images and with, you know, I mean, you know, when you're standing at a checkout counter of a supermarket, you know, look around. Everything that you can see or touch is going to be appealing to your instincts, your base instincts. Mm-hmm. Everything's going to be appealing to sustenance, you know, sugar, salts, fats, or sex or status. I mean, the tabloids are full of all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so our instincts are constantly being appealed to. So if having an evolutionary understanding of our brains and our psychology, recognizing that morality isn't something that's given from on high, but a morality emerges out of our primate, our mammalian and primate and hominid heritage. And when we understand, and this is one of the exciting things about primatology, is you recognize these deep emotions and this morality that emerges from our primate heritage. And that allows us to understand why it is that we've evolved beyond the morality of our sacred scriptures. I mean, scriptures that are 2,000 or 3,000 years old portray moral things that you can do that God supposedly tells us to do, that, you know, that was okay at that time or mandated, that today we'd all be horrified by. You know, we don't stone to death Sabbath breakers. And the reason we don't is because it would be immoral, you know. And so both understanding our psychology as it's evolved, our understanding of our instincts and how to have those instincts not cause us trouble but can actually help us to thrive, I would say that this issue of evolutionary psychology and evolutionary brain science is the place where more people of all different ages have real epiphanies, breakthroughs, like ahas, like wow. They come up to me after our programs, you know, Connie and I do programs, with tears in their eyes saying, wow, let me tell you how this made sense of this crisis or this situation or this thing in my life. So, yeah, I would say that it's probably the most universally interesting thing for people is understanding our nature. Teenagers, for example, just like are, you know, they're riveted when we get to talk about brain science and psychology because they want to know what's driving them.
Right. And I know one of the interesting things that you've spoken about with regard to this is how this new evolutionary understanding of kind of what makes us tick can kind of, in a sense, sort of re-illuminate some of the early kind of mythic scriptures that have really been sort of chucked by the wayside in modernity and post-modernity. For instance, this notion of original sin that, you know, obviously was an attempt to explain the fact that we have some parts of us that are not so wholesomely motivated and aren't even really serving our best interest, and yet, you know, we kind of are all of our self-destructive and destructive instincts towards others. And that was a mythic attempt to explain that. But I know you've reinvoked the notion of original sin, not as a way to make us feel bad, but in a sense to help us understand, you know, why we have these things.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the great gift of this sacred evolutionary understanding is that it reframes all traditional religious concepts. It naturalizes them. It realizes them. That it shows how they're real in this world, in this life, not just mythically so or in some future life or some place elsewhere after we die. They're real for us, or they can be experienced and interpreted as real in this life. And one of the examples, as you talk about, is you know, as you just mentioned, is original sin. I mean, original sin is a mythic intuition that points to the fact that we all have this unchosen nature that can sabotage us. The difference that an evolutionary worldview offers, however, and this is a vital difference, is it allows us, not only allows us, it supports us, it helps us to appreciate our instincts, to have gratitude for the fact that you and I wouldn't be having this conversation right now if it weren't for the fact that our ancestors had these instincts that allowed them to survive and reproduce. And having the appreciation, it's kind of like, you know, the phrase, what you resist persists. It's like as long as we keep judging ourselves, condemning ourselves, wishing that we were, you know, that they didn't have these instincts and trying to change them and trying to fix them and trying to heal ourselves and doing all this stuff with all this sort of judgmental energy, like, why am I this way? You know, why is it that I, you know, am challenged in this area or addicted in this area or struggle in this area or have these disempowering habits? When we can appreciate that almost all the things that we find troubling about ourselves and each other serve us in the distant past. It's amazing how much freedom can come just from that. I mean, I don't struggle with my quote-unquote sinful nature anymore in the way that I used to. Not even close. I mean, I find it almost effortless to live a life of impeccable integrity. And that doesn't mean perfection. What it means, though, is honoring my word, and it means living in service to the larger holons, the larger wholes of my existence, and keeping, staying in this place of having no secrets, no resentments, and no unfinished business. It's not a superhuman feat, but having gratitude has been, I think, the most important first step. I don't know any Christian, Muslim, or Jew, for example, to use to speak about the Western monotheistic traditions. I don't know of any Christian, Muslim, or Jew that genuinely has gratitude for their quote-unquote sinful nature. Because the story that we get out of the written scriptures doesn't facilitate that understanding. It really takes an evolutionary reframing of those stories.
Well, this is really interesting. I want to push into this a little bit more because I think there are some interesting tensions to kind of unpack here. Because you know what I hear. So in a sense, what I hear you in a sense responding to in the frame you just gave us is this. What we might consider a sort of traditional, mystical perspective on the lower parts of ourself or our you know less evolved nature, and you know within probably most of the great traditions, when a person was going to try to undergo a spiritual transformation, there was a sense of okay, I have to now grapple with all these parts of myself that are in a sense in opposition to the realization of my spiritual potential, all the parts of myself that I don't want to go along for the ride, you know, whether we called it the ego or inner demons, whatever it was, and then a spiritual battle, you know, was kind of brought to bear in within our own soul, you know, and this work of really clarifying the power of choice and freedom such that the person comes to a place where they can really choose to no longer identify with and therefore no longer be under the power of a lot of the, you know, less wholesome, less evolved parts of the self and, you know, destructive motivations, et cetera. And this path of purification obviously has to some degree, you know, and certainly in its less evolved interpretations, meaning its more popular interpretations, can lead to just a person feeling bad about themselves, beating up on themselves, just kind of feeling guilty that they are even tempted by these, you know, parts of themselves, and you know, in a sense, that could sabotage a lot of progress potentially. And so I kind of hear you saying that and saying, hey, let's not just fight against these parts of the self. Let's recognize, hey, that they exist for a reason. They might not be serving us anymore, but they used to serve us, and so therefore we should be grateful that they were there. But then what's the right relationship to them now? I guess that's where I want to push into because, you know, I'm a teacher. I work with a lot of people. I'm still very much trying to get people to take responsibility for the choice they make to either align with, you know, with the better angels of their nature or align with the more destructive aspects of their nature and to really clarify that choice and make the right choice. And, you know, I'm not even against guilt and shame, you know, as sort of motivating forces to say, look, you made a choice that was destructive, take responsibility for it, you know. But so I just want to get into that with you a little bit. What do you mean
Sure.
when you kind of, because I feel you trying, you saying guilt's a bad word. We want to.
Well, no, not at all. No, okay. I definitely don't. Yeah. I'm not saying that.
Okay.
What I'm trying to say is, in fact, I would say that if I were to try to articulate in a nutshell the approach to evolutionary spirituality that my book, Thank God for Evolution, offers, but that also that Connie and I have been teaching, preaching for 10 years, or 8 years actually, is that it's a practical-based, it's an integrity-based approach that's based on simple practices that allow us, that facilitate us to be guided by the fear that we have, the resentments that we have, the guilt that we have, because those are signals to us in terms of how to come into right relationship. Our feelings, our emotions, see, this is the thing.
Yeah.
Our emotions are part of the universe. They're the guidance that we have, the inner wisdom, the inner guidance. And so when we have guilt, fear, and resentment, for example, which are probably the three most disempowering emotions, gratitude, trust, and love being probably the three most empowering emotions, if your spiritual practice isn't measurably lessening your guilt, fear, and resentment, and increasing your gratitude, love, and trust, in other words, if it's not helping you fulfill your evolutionary calling, because to be free of guilt, resentment, and fear is to be empowered to find, you know, follow the place where your joy and the world's needs intersect. And in my opinion, there's some really basic core little extra. It's not about just sitting and meditating. It's not about just any of the traditional spiritual practices like prayer, like meditation, like, you know, chanting. Those are all very wonderful. They're valuable. I do them all. But I would say that far more important is having some basic practices, like, for example, stepping into the shoes of another person's interpretation and recognizing that my interpretation isn't the whole truth, that other people have different interpretations, and cleaning up some of the things in my life. I mean, I've nothing has given me more peace, more joy, more fulfillment in life than going to some people, you know, making a list, for example, of the people that I've harmed or betrayed, or just by pursuing my instincts. By doing what's natural, by doing what's effortless, I've left a wake. And that wake includes sometimes I've disappointed people, I've betrayed people, I've pissed people off or whatever. And so I wrote out a list of everybody I could think of, you know, that I had, you know, done harm to or in some way had a significant or even mildly, but, you know, negative impact on. And those people that I could track down, I communicated in one way or another. And so usually it was just easy little communication, but some of them were big. I mean, there was a couple of cases where all I could say was, I don't expect you to forgive me, but I want you to know that I know what a shit I was, and I'm really sorry. If I could go back and do it again, I really, really would. Mm-hmm. And that kind of communication where we actually take responsibility for our lives, where we step into the – I remember I had a teacher years ago, one of the most insightful things that anybody's ever offered. He said, if you want magic to occur in any relationship where there used to be closeness, there used to be love or affinity or, you know, closeness, and now there isn't. Now there's estrangement or sourness or, you know, whatever. He said, do the very thing that's the opposite of what we naturally instinctually do, which is we instinctually, when we're close to somebody and then there's a breaking of that or estrangement or whatever, we naturally take credit for everything that didn't, I mean, that did or does work in the relationship. We blame them for everything that didn't or doesn't, you know, work in the relationship. And they're, of course, doing the same thing. It's not a surprise that we stay in estrangement. He said, do the opposite of that. He said, you give them 100% credit for everything that did or does work in the relationship. You take 100% responsibility for everything that didn't or doesn't work in the relationship and then just shut up. And I've never had that fail. I've never had that fail to work magic. Tears follow almost always. And so that's a spiritual exercise. It's a spiritual practice. In fact, the heart of my book, Thank God for Evolution, is the section on evolutionary spirituality. And mostly they're just practices. They're just exercises. They're practices that help people come to healed relationships with people, and thriving relationships with the people that you're now in relationship with, such that they don't have to have wonderful personality. You just allow other people to be exactly as they are and exactly as they're not, and you love them anyway. And you can have a good relationship with virtually anybody, And sometimes that relationship means having boundaries and, you know, whatever. It doesn't mean, you know, just you're going to spend a lot of time with all these people. But it's possible to have a thriving relationship with virtually everybody in your life and to know that you could die tonight and you'd be complete, that everybody in your life who you love knows it because you've recently told them, and the people in your life who you've harmed or betrayed because of the wake that you've left, that you've done what you could to clean it up. And that is so, in my experience, spiritually empowering. It gives me such energy. There's no part of my psyche that's feeling guilty. And when there is guilt, when there is, you know, resentment, that's a signal to me that, oh, cool, I get to be in action to clean this up or to take responsibility or to apologize or to in some way listen to somebody and just really hear their perspective and hear their interpretation, not thinking that mine's the right one, but to really get in their shoes. And in my experience, that's utterly transforming.
Now, would you say that this endeavor to get in the other person's shoes, to see things from another perspective, is because doing so is going to help you get closer to what's actually true? Because I'm just wanting to see whether you're talking about getting beyond relativism. Because, again, you know, within the green meme or the postmodern kind of worldview, this is one of the great insights of postmodernity as well. Hey, we're all seeing through colored lenses to some degree, and, you know, we never have the whole truth. So that can kind of go one of two ways. It can go, well, therefore it's never possible to know the truth, and anybody's perspective is equally valid to anyone else's, and then we all kind of, you know, that there's a lot of separation in that potentially still, because we're just sort of honoring and acknowledging other people's perspectives but still holding our own. Another interpretation of that, though, would be to say, well, given that my perspective is probably limited, let me gather as much data as I can for how it looks from other angles, so that, you know, and hopefully we could do that together and maybe start to come to something that's more true, more complex understanding. Is it that direction you're
pushing? Absolutely, absolutely. I am not a postmodern relativist. I mean, I find value in the postmodern, what we've learned through that form of consciousness, that form of thinking. But one of the great gifts of, whether you call it integral or second tier or simply evolutionary consciousness, is the recognition that we can finally step back into language of speaking about right and wrong, for example. Something is right if it values diversity, if it furthers the evolution of life, this 14 billion year process of increasing complexity, cooperation and interdependence. Something's wrong if it violates that or works against that. So when I'm in relationship with somebody, I'm assuming that the truth is larger than either one of our perspectives. And it's not just like, well, you know, one truth, another truth, here's, you know, everybody's got their own truth, you know, whatever. I mean, that is true from a subjective perspective, that we each have our own interpretations. So to the degree that I can get inside your interpretation and see the world as you do, I'm more likely to have my heart touched. I'm more likely to feel a sense of connection. And we're more likely together to come to some new breakthrough or new understanding or new agreement that wasn't there, as long as we're simply valuing our own interpretation and you know, saying what the hell's wrong with you, you know, the other person or whatever. So yes, for me, it's always in service of what life has been up to. This comes back to the beginning of our conversation, you know, the big questions: who are we, where do we come from, where's everything going? And understanding that gives us some, I want to say moral authority, but it's not really that. It gives us a ground, a common conceptual ground, a common ground to stand on, where we can find that out of our conversation, out of our sharing of our perspectives, we can find something new that emerges, some synthesis, some insight, some understanding that is transformative and that can bring us both into making a better contribution on behalf of the body of life.
I want to have one more kind of piece I want to bring out around this conversation about what you call our inherited proclivities, are these, you know, maybe aspects of our nature that no longer serve us in a sense, but that, you know, used to really work well when we were living a different kind of life. And that is, because in a sense, I think when you're using this term big integrity, you're talking about also coming into right relationship to those. And the reason I'm going into this, pushing into this more is because I know for so many people on the spiritual path, on the transformative path, you know, people wonder what to do with all that stuff, you know, and there's, of course, we have these notions of enlightenment and what it would be to be an enlightened or realized being, and a lot of people wonder, well, does it mean that you would no longer feel like, you know, all temptation to be lazy, self-centered, you know, aggressive, whatever, deceptive, that all of that, you would no longer ever feel any impulse to do those things, or just that you would attain a certain relationship to all those things where you would no longer act out of them? And what do you see from your point of view? I have my own take on this, obviously, but what do you see as the possibility there? Like, what's possible, what's realistic for a human being to sort of attain or come to in relation to that whole batch of kind of messed up or difficult stuff that exists within us?
Yeah. Well, at an earlier time in my life, when I was operating out of a fairly conservative Christian worldview, I struggled deeply, daily, almost daily, with my inherited proclivities. And I ended up doing years of workshops, coaching, psychological transformation. I did, you know, several years of neuro-linguistic programming and landmark education and every kind of workshop down the pike, from shamanism to, you know, various aspects of Buddhism and retreats and all kinds of stuff. And largely I was motivated by how to have freedom around my unchosen nature, how to not be sabotaged, how to have these things serve my life. And as I shared earlier, the biggest shift for me, unquestionably, was moving from the sort of attainment model that this was a state to be obtained, whether it be, you know, through Jesus from the outside saving me from my sin and then whatever, or to use less traditionally Christian language, you know, that I would achieve some enlightened state where I was no longer tempted or troubled or offset by these. All of that kind of came together as a result of simply practicing some of these exercises that I talk about in Chapter 11 of my book, but also in terms of following my bliss, following my passion, my joy, doing whatever I could to contribute to the world and not waiting till I had it all together for that to be the case. And it mostly came as a result of getting to this place, as I said before, of having no secrets, no resentments, and no unfinished business. That place is so freeing that I can just speak from my personal experience, is that I now notice, it's not that I don't feel temptation, I don't feel all the things I've felt before, but those things don't lead me, they don't guide me, they're not the rider on the horse. I feel like I'm in heaven. I'm in this place of, like, you know, what they call the peace that passes all understanding on a regular basis. And it comes almost solely out of an evolutionary understanding of my brain, an evolutionary understanding of my psyche, and simply some basic relationship, practical relationship practices that have facilitated that. So I don't know what else, what to say beyond that.
Okay. Well, I have another area I want to go into a little bit, which is something that, you know, today in kind of contemporary progressive spirituality, one of the great kind of targets everybody's aiming for or kind of, you know, iconic ideas is this notion that, you know, to be a truly spiritual person is to abide in the present moment, to be in the now. And, you know, this is something, you know, we hear from many different teachers and you know, many seekers would say that's really where spirituality's at, when you're just being in the moment. And I was reading a blog post of yours recently, and I found something I love, which was, I'm going to quote it back to you. You said, "The present moment is highly overrated. From an evolutionary perspective, the past and the future are where it's at. Any aardvark, antelope, cat, or cockroach can effortlessly reside in the present moment." And I wanted to just say, I was delighted to read this because it's something I'm pushing on quite a bit. You know, I have this line on my website that being in the now is the least important part of the spiritual path. But so I would love to kind of get from you why you wrote that, what you mean by it, and particularly what's a spiritual relationship to the past and the future? Because I think, many of us are thinking, you need to just let go of the past and let go of any attachment to the future and just be here now, and that's where it's at. So I want to hear a more evolutionary approach to all this from you.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question.
You know I have my own, but I want to hear yours.
Sure. Well, the next sentence that I write after saying any, aardvark, antelope, cat, or cockroach can effortlessly reside in the present moment is I say only human beings can engage deeply with the past and consciously co-create the future. And I think that's the key piece. I mean, clearly, it is deep. It is inspiring. It's empowering. It's peace-producing. It's comforting. It's centering to be able to come into the present moment, to not be simply ruled by whatever ideas, thoughts, fears, resentments, or whatever in the past, or whatever fears and anticipation or whatever that we have about the future, but to come into the present moment and to be able to just simply notice rather than think. And that's really what, centering practices do. They help you come into the present moment by noticing rather than thinking. And so, for example, one of the practices that I've done for years and recommend is noticing two or more sensory stimuli at the same moment. And that's an easy, effortless way. Some people meditate for years and years and years and never realize how powerful that tool is. But that's only one small piece of the spiritual path. And in fact, as you say, I love what you said, it's not the most important. It may be the least important. It's vital. But what I think is having an integrity relationship with the past is to get to the place of recognizing that whatever happened in the past, I can't change. But I can change my interpretation of it. I can look at it differently. And the fact of the matter is we can all see our lives in a mythic way. And the myths always have these catastrophes and this chaos that happens, and yet, the hero in a myth is inspired or empowered or in some way made better or softened or whatever. And so when we see our own lives in a mythic context, we recognize that no matter how traumatic or painful or disastrous or whatever things have happened in our past, we can choose to interpret those things in a way that isn't disempowering, but that is in fact empowering. And none of us would be where we are today if it weren't for that. And so that for me, part of what is having a sacred or meaningful relationship to the past, an integrous relationship to the past, to be in right relationship with my past, is to interpret my own life history, my own life story, from the place that I'm grateful for everything that has occurred in my life to this moment. That's not to say I do things the same way. It's not to say I wish certain things didn't happen, or when I was a child, certain things happened to me by others. Of course, that's the case. But I've come to interpret those things in a way that allows me to have gratitude, a way that allows me to appreciate my life for having been just what it is. Mm. Not that I wish those things would happen again, or that I would wish them on others. Having a relationship to the future is to take responsibility. First of all, it's to recognize the trajectory of life. This is why I'm so looking forward to John Stewart's and some of your other presenters or people you'll be having conversations with, but I found a tremendous value from John Stewart's work, his whole notion of evolution's arrow. And it's not just him. I mean, some of the amazing evolutionary thinkers are coming to this understanding and have been articulating this understanding that life, there's a trajectory of greater complexity, interdependence, and cooperation. And so to the degree that I can look into the future and see patterns and trends that have been at work for a long time, both in the pre-human world and in the human world, and then align myself with those trends and participate in the emergence of what will be reality for others in the future, there's an energy that's released. There's a dynamism that is so invigorating that it wakes, you know, I wake up in the morning, I'm excited to be alive. I go to sleep at night, I'm excited, you know, and it's largely because I'm participating in this billions-year-old process from a place of consciousness or awareness and gratitude. So I when I look to the past, I have gratitude. And you know, there's a zillion examples, you know, that I go into in my book and that we can talk about in terms of, you know, that the catastrophes in the past that have almost always been creative. I mean, there's, you know, I have a set of beads where each bead signifies a significant event in the universe story. I've got 250 beads, and each of them is a transformational moment that was preceded by some chaos, some challenge, some difficulty. So when I see that over and over and over again, it allows to trust the chaos, the challenges, and the difficulties in my life. And so that's inspiring. That's faith building. It's trust building. And when I look to the future, I have that level of trust. So I have gratitude when I look to the past. I have trust when I look to the future. And I'm inspired in the moment to be in action, no matter what the chaos or challenges that life happens to give us. And that is, I think, core, at least to my understanding, of evolutionary spirituality.
That's beautifully said. And on this point about the future, I want to go there a little more too, because, you know, I think one of the insights of evolution that I think we're still barely beginning to integrate psychologically, so to speak, is this recognition that nothing's fixed, that the way, you know, because we human beings, you know, we're oriented locally and we're kind of oriented in terms of short-term kind of periods of time, because, you know, when we, during the vast tracts of our evolution, you know, we didn't have any broad perspective on time. We didn't have any broad perspective on distance. Everything was local and everything was short-term. And so there's a way in which I think, you know, we sort of just still tend to kind of think, well, what it is to be a human is what it is. You know, this is how we are. And even ourselves, we kind of think, well, I'm me, and this is who I am, and I'm always going to kind of be the same person. And yes, I may evolve and transform in certain ways, but I'm still going to be the same basic person. And, you know, and human beings are going to kind of always be the same. And it creates a kind of built-in cynicism almost, in a sense, about what's possible. And there's something about waking up to the reality that evolution is happening, has always been happening, will continue to happen, that if we really meditate on that, contemplate on that, it can start to fill us with this sense of, wow, you know, I could completely change. All the things that I feel so troubled by, plagued by, negative patterns I have, could really completely change. The whole human story, with all of the horror, you know, of killing each other and raping each other, and just the horror show of the human condition, could also completely evolve. And, you know, and actually we could consciously participate in that. And then, wow, what's my role in this? and I want to just hear from you a little bit, because I know one of the things you teach about and work with people is that kind of finding your evolutionary calling, your role in helping co-create the future. And, you know, say a little bit about how you would encourage, because I know it's a question a lot of people have. How can I contribute? What is my role? What is my place in this vast cosmos?
Yeah.
How do you help people get there?
Well, first of all, I'd say to the first part of what you said, that it is profoundly possible to change, to make major changes in one's life, and to not be troubled by the things that have troubled you for decades. I not only know that from my own experience, but from countless others that have given me feedback over the years in terms of how a sacred, meaningful evolutionary perspective has done that for them. How it's transformed their relationship to old standing habits and patterns in their life. So that is possible, and humanity itself, from a collective standpoint, we have been changing so rapidly, but we don't see it unless we step back and take a look at these long-term patterns. That's one of the reasons why I'm so entranced by this evolutionary story that's, again, the evolution of everyone and everything, including human evolution in our human cultures. And the exercise that you're referring to, that you're pointing to, that I talk about in my book, but also that I often offer to audiences, is it's real simple. You take a piece of paper, draw a line down the middle, so you've got two columns, and on the left-hand side, you list all the you know, the things that trouble you, that you know, break your heart, where you feel the world's needs, like not just where you intellectually know about what's needed, but where does it hit you? Where do you feel it? You know, where do you get pissed off or frustrated or depressed or whatever? And you list all that stuff. And then on the other side, on the right side of the paper, you list all the things that you're good at, where you feel the, you, but where basically where your great joy, all the things that light you up, turn you on, give you joy, give you energy, the things you're good at, the things that other people tell you that you're good at, etc. And you list all that stuff. So at the top of one list, you've got the world's great needs as I feel them. At the top of the other list, you've got, you know, my great joy.
Mm-hmm.
And then you simply pay attention to your heart. And here's where coming into the present moment is really useful. Pay attention to your heart. Notice your own heart and ask guidance from right there, from that center place in your chest. Ask guidance. Basically, you're trying to play mix and match. Where are the intersections between what, you know, what lights you up, what gives you joy, what gives you energy, and what the world's needs are or your community's needs as you feel them? And those intersections where your great joy and the world's great needs intersect, that's your calling. That's your mission. That's your vocation. That's where you can be the growing edge of what God or spirit or life or the universe is up to. And whether you can make money at it or not is irrelevant. I mean, just taking one step a month in the direction of where your joy and the world's needs intersect will do more to lift you out of your depression or do more to take your focus and energy off of your own problems. And all of a sudden, some of the things that you were experiencing as problematic begin evaporating. It's not like you resolve them or solve them, they just evaporate. They're no longer issues for you. Your attention and energy is on being a blessing to the world and to the future, and in so doing, you find yourself being hugely blessed.
That's beautiful, Michael. Really nice. I'm sure it's going to be really helpful for a lot of people, too. I get this question so often, so... That's great.
Well, you know, there's one other thing, Craig, that I just want to mention, because one of the things that I promised in the description of this was that I'd offer, you know, exercise, and I've talked a couple about them, but just one more that I just want to just make mention, because it's been utterly life-changing for me, and that is just expressing gratitude in a way that really makes a difference for the other person. I remember, probably 20 years ago now, hearing a teaching of where a woman had basically been challenged to do exactly that, to basically express gratitude, to express thanksgiving to the people in her life that had really made a difference, whatever. So she went to her boss and did so, and it was completely transformative. I mean, it changed her relationship to her boss and everything else. And so I heard that story, and I said, okay, you know, who are the people in my life who I owe a debt of gratitude to? Well, my parents were the first ones who came to mind, and others as well. So I wrote my mother and my father, each a letter. They were long divorced. And I wrote my father like a 12-page letter where I just went through all the things in my life that I could remember that I had never expressed gratitude to him for. And I didn't focus on any of the other problematic or challenging things. I just focused on the things that I could be grateful for. And it was like a 12-page letter. And what I was unprepared for was the fact that this letter was bathed in my tears. I mean, it just blew me out of the water to do this. And I sent it to my father, and I found out later that it had the same effect on him reading it. And I didn't have a bad relationship to my dad, but ever since that experience, my relationship to my father shifted completely. And I've not had the same relationship to my father, and that was over 20 years ago. Well, when I was in seminary, I was talking with the business manager. I was in a 3-year seminary program, Eastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. And I was in conversation with the business manager, and we got on the topic of gratitude. And I told her this story about me and my dad. And I didn't think anything of it. Well, about 4 days later, I'm coming into the front door of the seminary, and she says, Michael, come here. And she takes me into her office. And I'm thinking, like, what did I do wrong? Because she was a rather gruff, curmudgeonly sort of person, and I thought, you know, what's the deal? Well, she shut the door, and she said, remember you told me the story of this woman and her boss and then you and your dad? And I said, yeah. She said, well, I was really challenged by that. She said, I've been married for 47 years. She said, she said it was 17 pages typewritten single-space letter where I went through all the things in our relationship that I'd never thanked him for, and I sent it to his office. She said, I just talked to him maybe 20 minutes ago on the phone. She said, I haven't heard my husband cry in 25 years. She said, thank you for telling me those stories.
Well, and Thanks, Michael. That's really great. So I could go on with you for a long time. We're at the point in the call where we're going to bring some other folks in and let them ask you their questions. So before we do, I'm just going to briefly mention how people can get in touch with you. There's your personal website, which is michaeldowd.org. There's your book website, which is thankgodforevolution.com. Your blog is on which site?
My blog, yeah, I spent a lot of time in preparation for this call and just uploaded my latest blog post, which is really sort of an essay that my wife and I both worked on, called Evolutionary Spirituality, Coming Home to Reality. And so that's on, if you just go to my Thank God for Evolution website, right there on the home page, it's the latest thing that's there, thankgodforevolution.com. You'll find
it. And Michael, also you have your podcast, which is America's Evolutionary Evangelist, and that you can find at thegreatstory.org/podcast.
Yeah, the great story is the main website that we've had for 8 years. Connie's the webmaster. It's just there's practical educational stuff for kids and adults. It's worth spending, you know, a good half hour or longer just seeing what's on that website and seeing what you're drawn to. But yeah, the podcast is certainly one of the things that Connie and I are having the most fun with.
Nice. Okay, great. Well, we'll mention all that again at the end. I just wanted to get it in now in case some people jump off early.
Cool.
But so now we move on to the question and answer part of the night. If you have a question, simply send us your question via instant message in the teleseminar window on your computer, or you can dial into the conference line number and press *2 to let us know that you have a question. This is not the Maestro conference number, by the way, and we're still, you know, trying to help clarify for everybody because there are two aspects to these events. There's the hour and a half teleseminar, which we're in now, and then afterwards there's the Evolutionary Cafe, which you have to dial into separately so we can put you in breakout groups, and it's a little more complex. So we're not doing that now. We're just doing question and answers with Michael. Before we take your questions, I just have a few things to let you know about from our sponsors that are making all this possible. First of all, if you're interested in diving deeper into what it means to live an evolutionary life, I'm excited to announce that I'll be teaching a 9-week telecourse on what it means to put evolutionary spirituality into practice. That starts in about 10 days. It's called Integral Enlightenment, Awakening to an Evolutionary Relationship to Life. And you can learn more about this and other upcoming course offerings of ours at academyforevolutionaries.com. That's academyforevolutionaries.com. I also want to thank our partners at Gaia Community, an online sanctuary of nearly 300,000 seekers, artists, and visionaries committed to inspiring and empowering each other to live lives of purpose and authenticity. And they've also recently launched Gaia Soulmates, which is, believe it or not, a fledgling dating site for singles looking for a partner who shares their values of spiritual awareness and personal inquiry. You can find out about both of those at Gaia.com. That's Gaia.com. Also wanted to tell you about an upcoming retreat. It's the Being and Becoming virtual retreat with Andrew Cohen. You can spend 2 days at the cutting edge of human evolution from the privacy of your own home. Join Andrew Cohen and hundreds of evolutionaries around the world for EnlightenNext's first ever virtual retreat. Now you don't have to travel to experience the transformational power of an evolutionary enlightenment retreat. For more information and to receive a free audio seminar by Andrew Cohen, you can click on the link in the email that we sent you yesterday. It has a direct link to that webpage, and that's going to be coming up February 13th and 14th. Also, for those of you living in Northern California, particularly in the San Francisco Bay Area, I just want to mention an upcoming event next week. Hosted by Bay Area Integral, which is the local Integral community out here. And it's called Embodying the Impulse of Evolution. It's next Wednesday evening, January 27th in San Rafael, California. And in this experiential evening, evolutionary pioneer Terry Patton and me are going to guide an exploration of what it means to live a spiritual life 24/7, not just in occasional glimpses or sitting on the meditation cushion. So join us as we explore how we can begin to create a culture together that will help us grow and evolve and contribute to the emergence of a humane and sustainable and evolving world. And you can learn all about that and find a full calendar of Bay Area Integral events at BayAreaIntegral.com. That's BayAreaIntegral.com. We'd love to have you in the local community and connect with you. So that's it for the advertisements tonight. If you have a question, simply send it to us via instant message in the teleseminar window on your computer, or dial into the conference line number and press *2 to let us know you have a question. When you press *2, it raises your hand on the computer interface and we can call on you. So let's go ahead and start out taking a live caller, first of all. And David Berger, our engineer, is going to help us out with this tonight. So David, you can go ahead and just call on somebody. And by the way, we can't always see your name. It just depends on how your caller ID is set up on your phone. We may just see the city you're from. We may not even see that. So we'll call on you by whatever means we can, depending on how you're showing up on our screen. So do we have someone, David?
We do. We have a question from Greeley, Colorado. Zach Hancock, you're on the line with us.
Hi, Zach.
Yeah, hi. Hi, I'm actually in Bend, Oregon now. But my question, I was really interested in everything that was said, and the thing that kind of came up for me was concerning, you know, the evolution of our integrity, the evolution of our gratitude, our love. I guess what I have a question about is, in the sense of evolution being sort of a, you know, the strongest, survival of the strongest, how does that connect with, or how would you speak to that as far as being, you know, loving and generous for the other?
Yeah. Great question, Zach. One of the things that's in a major shift right now is how we characterize evolution. For well over 100 years, for actually probably close to 150 years, evolution has been characterized, in other words, it's been kind of shorthand. If you ask many people what they think about evolution, two phrases come to mind. One of them is survival of the fittest, and that's usually interpreted as meaning survival of the most dominant. And the other phrase that comes up is evolution nature red in tooth and claw, meaning creatures eat other creatures. And, of course, both of those carry sort of an inaccurate slant and a negative slant, the second one. Survival of the fittest has come to mean, and one of the things we've learned a lot about in the last 30 years is that symbiosis, mutualism, relationships where there is a mutual benefit are rampant throughout all of life in all the different kingdoms, all, you know. And so cooperation is essential to how evolution proceeds as competition is. Competition is absolutely there, no question about that. But competition and cooperation feed each other. They spiral each other. And so when I am participating in finding ever more effective ways of being authentic, being transparent, being responsible, listening to the perspective of another, finding greater ground to cooperate, when I expand my circle of compassion to include people that my grandparents thought were enemies, I am participating in the evolutionary impulse. I'm participating in this flow of evolution. So survival of the fittest has come to also, we now see, as survival of that which fits best with its environment. And in order to fit best, it often requires cooperation. And certainly in the human realm, it absolutely does. We can't thrive if we don't cooperate with others. So I want to be really clear in some of the old characterizations of what evolution is are not accurate. For example, the one nature red in tooth and claw, you get the sense that means, you know, that's kind of like, oh, no, that shouldn't be. Well, all that is pointing to the fact that creatures eat other creatures, and that's how evolution proceeds. You can also interpret it with a positive mythic spin, which is the entire body of life is in a state of holy communion all the time. The entire body of life is saying, take, eat, this is my body which is given for you. Now, obviously, that's a mythic interpretation, but it's one that has a positive spin rather than the negative spin of nature red in tooth and claw.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Well, thank you. That helps.
That's fantastic, Michael. Thanks. And thanks, Zach, for your question. Really interesting stuff. So we'll take one from instant message here because we try to balance the way these come in. This is from Richard in Mill Valley, California. It says, natural selection in biology involves the elimination of failed attempts. What gives you confidence that we can evolve intelligently in ways we think is good? Good for whom?
Well, I would say good for the larger body of life of which we're a part and upon which we utterly depend. One of the things, again, that the worldwide self-correcting scientific enterprise is helping us to do is to pay attention at scales and at speeds that our primate brain is not going to naturally pay attention to. And we're also recognizing that human beings can't thrive in a sick and dying world, that the only way that humans can thrive into the future is to live in a mutually enhancing relationship where the body of life upon which we depend thrives and we thrive in that context. It's really shifting from thinking of human beings in a consumer sort of way. I mean, to consume is to eat something up. I mean, cancer consumes a body, and part of it is because the cancer thinks it's separate. The cancer cells think it's separate from the body, so it starts to consume the body of which we're a part. Well, we call our society consumer society, you know, and it means to eat up. And why are we eating up the planet? Is it because we're bad, rotten, evil, crummy, sinful people, or is it because, like the cancer cell, we thought we were separate from Earth, we thought we were separate from the universe, and recognizing that we are the universe, becoming conscious of itself, that we're the result of 14 billion years of divine creativity, gives us a connection to our larger self and a sense that we're participating in this larger unfolding that goes beyond natural selection. It's the evolution of galaxies, the evolution of star systems, the evolution of life, and the evolution of human cultures, which cooperation, as I said before, is central to. So part of it is that, and part of it is also recognizing that instead of being a cancer-like agent in the body of life where we consume the body, we can become, and we are becoming, and we will over the course of the next 50 to 80 years much more significantly become an immune system where we recognize that humans can foster and defend and protect the health and the well-being of the larger body of life in the way that an immune system does. And that shift in a mythic mindset to seeing ourselves as humanity becoming like an immune system, we will begin to thrive in a major way in that context. And that's our great work. And that's what young people are turned on by, is this vision of where they and their generation can make a heroic difference.
Fantastic. That's really great. Thank you. All right, we're going to jump in and bring on another caller. David, you want to call on someone?
Yes, we have a question from Stockton, Illinois. Jaquel, you're on the line with us.
Thanks for taking my call. And hello, Michael Dowd, Jackie Ziegler.
Hey, Jackie.
Looking forward to connecting with you in a different way. Michael, you just spoke about generosity and mutualism. Can you relate that to the political arena today? I'm finding it very difficult to have compassion and to want to cooperate because I'm not finding there's any cooperation or even a sense that there's a mutuality involved in the way our world is going or just in the United States. So are you able to address that?
Well, I can try. People sometimes say to me, you know, you sound so optimistic about the future. I mean, you sound so positive. You know, are you just a natural-born optimist? And I say, no. I mean, an optimist is somebody who believes it doesn't matter what we do, things are going to get better and better. A pessimist, somebody who believes it doesn't matter what we do, things are going to get worse and worse. You know, I'm a meliorist, like the word ameliorate, I'm a meliorist. I believe what we do is going to make a huge difference, and there's no guarantee one way or the other. But I'm deeply hopeful, and one of the things that gives me hope is that I have a deep and profound trust in chaos, in conflict. Because when conflict is there, that's what's real. So then the pertinent question is, okay, this is what's real. What's possible now? And yes, it is definitely easily possible to look at the current political realities and feel overwhelmed, to feel depressed, to feel a draining of energy. But part of that is usually because we're not recognizing, let me just speak personally. I look at the challenges today and, you know, I think, okay, it's perhaps not unfolding at the speed or exactly in the ways that I would like, and there's so many things I can get depressed about. But again, when we step back and take a look at the fact that we wouldn't have, for example, Barack Obama in the White House today if it hadn't been for the things that have unfolded in the last 15 years and the George Bush presidency that has led to where we are today. And today's challenges, today's stupidity, today's chaos will feed ways that we collaborate and move forward in the future. And so I think what each of us can do is follow those places where our joy and the world's needs intersect. But to the degree that we can remind ourselves that chaos is perhaps the single most important thing that fuels the process, and to the degree that we can be a profound stand for the transformation of our whole political ways of being, our economic ways of being, and do what we can to transform those in our own locations and through our voting and everything else, but, you know, to work for the transformation of our systems, our structures that we participate in that almost make it inevitable that we'll do stupid things. When we recognize that chaos has a profound role, that can feed our trust so that we can be engaged for change, for transformation, for, you know, sustainability, for justice, for peace. But we do so from the place of recognizing that our own stupidities, our own faults, our own challenges, our own failures, and the failures of our government or whatever, those all feed the creative process. So that can allow us to feel a sense of trust and inspiration, even in the midst of where things go wrong and where things are not unfolding in the way that we wish they were, or that could, or, you know, that we think could. So I know that's not, I mean, that perhaps doesn't fully answer your question, Jackie, but I know that's what gives me inspiration is when I see countless examples of chaos, breakdowns, catastrophes, stupidities that have fed the creative process, that allows me to trust the chaos that we're now dealing with, the stupidities that we're now dealing with, the resistance to transformation that we're now dealing with, from a place of compassion rather than judgment. And from a purely pragmatic standpoint, when we can engage as activists truly from a second tier or an integral perspective, where we see our differences as not a problem to be solved, but that our differences are a solution to our problems, we can then be a stand for the healthy ways that we're envisioning unfolding, but also relate to those who have a differing perspective or, as we see it, a less evolved perspective from a place of compassion.
Thank you,
fantastic,
Michael.
Hey, thanks, Jackie, for your call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Jackie.
Good to have you on. Great. Okay, I'm going to take one here from Instant Message. This is from Robert in Cannon City, Colorado, asking, how do you try to move people to a higher understanding of reality, which may challenge their views and cause conflict? You indicated that with people you've had conflict with in the past, you have assumed responsibility for the conflict. That works with past events. In the present, what you consider true and worthy of sharing with others may cause conflict, which you will have to take responsibility for later. So would this lead you into passivity to avoid conflict in the present so you don't have to assume responsibility for it later?
Great question. I can only speak from my own personal experience on something like that. I do not avoid conflict. I just have come to the belief that the more I can be transparent, the more I can be authentic, the more I can share what I'm really thinking and feeling, even though it may make somebody uncomfortable, even though it may, and doing so responsibly, doing not irresponsibly, but doing so responsibly, I have found more breakthroughs. I mean, I've got family members that are very different from where I'm coming from politically, economically, religiously, worldview-wise. And yet we've got really amazing relationships because I do not hesitate from being really authentic about what I really think, what I really feel, what I honestly believe, and doing so responsibly such that they trust that I'm really being authentic. And we've had amazing conversations. And in fact, there's been a lot of people that I've related to that I've helped move them to what I think is more evolved perspective precisely because I wasn't trying to get them to do so. And those people, I'm asked a lot, how do you relate to fundamentalists? How do you relate to people who just don't get evolution, that don't get ecology. And my genuine response is I just love them. I just accept them exactly as they are, exactly as they're not. I trust that if they go to their grave like that, that's fine. But I excitedly share why I think or feel differently or how I view the world, you know, how I view evolution in an inspiring way. But because I'm not trying to get them to change, I'm not trying to fix them or heal them or convert them, and they can feel that. There's nothing in them that resists me there's not that resistance. And so I've actually made a lot of progress with a lot of people precisely because I've just accepted them as they are, and I've been fully authentic with what I'm thinking and feeling and what I value most deeply.
Great, thanks. Really clear. I have a simple question I'll take on instant message that I know is something you probably know a lot about. It's from Rosalie in Indianapolis asking, are there resources available that coordinate biblical scriptures with evolutionary principles? Well, one really good one, Rosalie, is Michael's book, Thank God for Evolution. Would you agree, Michael?
Well, yeah, thanks, Craig.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I'm not trying to do in my book, Thank God for Evolution, I mean, I think one of the reasons why it was endorsed by so many Nobel laureates and science people and religious people and stuff is that it offers conceptual common ground for people who are devoutly religious of lots of different traditions and also people who are non-religious or even anti-religious. I mean, I've got evangelicals and atheists that have both endorsed my book excitedly. And I think part of it is that there is a way, it's a common spirituality. It's a pragmatic, practical form of thinking about evolutionary spirituality and evolutionary theology. And I think if we can't find ways of cooperating across ethnic and religious differences in the next 50 years, we're in serious trouble. So I don't start with the Bible. I don't start with trying to reconcile science to biblical teaching. In fact, if I do anything, I do the opposite. I start with what reality is revealing to us today through the entire worldwide enterprise, what I call public revelation, what God is not just revealing privately to individuals, but publicly through the whole worldwide enterprise. And then I start with that and say, okay, how can this perspective, what's being revealed today globally, how can that enrich and strengthen and deepen our faith? And that's where I think that's certainly where I find the most inspiration, and that's where a lot of people have found inspiration, whether they be religious or non-religious. But I do try to take some of the core concepts or theology, or, you know, kind of doctrines in Christianity, and show how these can be realized or made real. And I do that in my book.
Great. Okay. And I imagine you have more resources on that as well on your website?
Yeah, in fact, if you just put into Google best evolution resources, my page will probably be the first thing that comes up, best evolution resources. And I have links to some of the best books and articles on, a meaningful interpretation of the universe, how it is that we know that evolution is true. How it is that we can see that morality and ethics emerge out of the body of life and out of our primate heritage and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of resources there, but also this article that I just uploaded to my website today on evolutionary spirituality in terms of coming home to reality, I also list some resources there at the end. So, again, that's on my Thank God for Evolution website. And then, the great story website that Connie has that we've not just she and I, but we've had contributions from many, 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 many people from around the world. It's a great resource place there.
Great. Yeah. So check all of those out. And I'm going to go over by a few minutes because I kind of hogged you to myself a little too long, and I want to give a few more people a chance to ask you questions. So let's go ahead and take one more caller. David, you want to bring someone on? David, do we have a caller? I bet he's got himself muted. Okay. Well, while we're dealing with that, I'll just ask you another one via Instant Teleseminar here. Let's see. All right, this is a good kind of last question. It's from Scott in Oklahoma City. In your opinion, what's the most important universal tip or principle to keep in mind at most all times in order to evolve in a positive way?
I'd say make life right. My mantra is making life right. In other words, you know, you can use religious language, talking about faith in God, trusting the universe, accepting what's so, loving what is, celebrating what's real. All those are different ways of saying what I like to say in terms of making life right. And to the degree that I can make life right, both the life within me and the life around me, those my circumstances external to me and also my feelings within me, what that does is it naturally keeps me in the place of gratitude, trust, and inspiration. But in terms of a question, what it keeps me is from the place of what's possible now. Okay, if I'm making life right, that is whatever's real, whatever's undeniably so in the moment. Okay, making life right is just accepting that as it is. This is what's real. Okay, what's possible now? And so that, you know, I mean, I've had other affirmations that I talk about in Chapter 12 of my book. The whole section in my book on evolutionary spirituality is really practical exercises. And, you know, some of them have been affirmations, you know, like everything is perfect for my growth and learning. You know, if I just repeat that to myself a lot, which I did years ago, and now it's just second nature, then when something happens to me that is unpleasant, painful, or whatever, rather than going into blame or judgment, I say, okay, what's possible now? Or I say to myself something like, okay, how is this perfect for my growth and learning? And I have a different relationship to it precisely because I have this thought that's now a part of the structure of my consciousness. But it took exercise. It took practice to develop that. It really is, you know, spiritual practice is just that. It's spiritual practice. But again, I would encourage people, you know, when they think about spiritual practice, not only to think about sitting on a cushion or meditating, but, you know, spend a half hour a day doing some of these exercises that you know, significantly lessen or completely evaporate because you've cleaned things up, you know, guilt, fear, resentment, so that you literally can be to the place of having no resentments, no judgments, no fear, no secrets. But back to the question, making life right has been probably the most empowering thing for me.
Mm. Great. Thanks, Michael. We're going to take one more caller live. David, do you have someone?
Yeah, we have an unnamed caller from Santa Cruz, California. Santa Cruz, go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm Timothy Wilkin in Carmel.
Hi, Timothy.
Thank you. I wanted to say this was a wonderful program, and I really enjoyed it. Michael, you had made a sort of a versus parallel. You said guilt, resentment, and fear, gratitude, love, and then there was one other thing.
What trust.
Trust. Yeah, trust. Excellent. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Michael wanted to suggest one thing. I'm a physician, and Candace Pert, I don't know if you're aware of her work. She has a wonderful meditation called Psychosomatic Wellness, which is the most powerful healing program I've ever experienced, and I've been studying healing meditations for 20 years. And it's very powerful for those who have been challenged with cancer, and I'm one of those people, so I wanted to share that with you.
Thank you, Timothy. So if I put into Google Candace Pert psychosomatic wellness, I'll get there. Right?
Absolutely.
Fabulous. Thank you. I really appreciate that tip.
Craig, this is wonderful, and what you're doing for all of us, and I want to thank you so, so much.
Well, thank you. Hey, I really appreciate it. Thanks for your comments and for helping Michael out. I'm really glad to hear things have gone well, Michael, in your battle with cancer, and keeping our fingers crossed for the next round, but really bowing to you and the way you've carried it, which has been with a lot of dignity and humility and, frankly, trust, which is walking your talk.
Well, thanks, Craig.
Go ahead.
One thing I want to say before we're done with this call, which is that I just want to, first of all, deeply appreciate you and Carter for the very generous ways that you all talked about me last week. I was touched. And also, the work that you're doing, bringing together these various thought leaders, these teleseminars, these courses, you're really paving an important path, and you're really emerging as a significant leader in this larger movement. And you know, I've known you as a friend and a colleague for quite some time, and the integrity, the authenticity, the responsibility, the humility that you approach this work is a real model for the rest of us. And I just want to acknowledge and bow to you and thank you for just this incredible work that you're doing. I'm sure that we will all look back years from now with deep gratitude for the coalescing of this movement that you are playing a key role in. So thank you.
Wow. Thank you. I really appreciate it, Michael. Well, you know, I feel the same way about you, and you've been such a major catalyst for the whole conversation and, you know, really taking it out there into the mainstream in ways that a lot of us aren't and perhaps even can't because we're such fanatics. So you've found a way to be a healthy fanatic and still bring it out to the big public, which is, you know, just a huge role. So great. So, Michael, do you have anything you want to tell us about in terms of upcoming plans or visions? I just want to create a window for you to mention anything you want to tell people about to keep an eye out for.
Yeah. Well, I'm in the process of creating both a free webinar and an online home study course titled Evolutionize Your Life, Coming Home to Reality. And it will be the most extensive kind of collection of things that I've written about and recorded, and my wife and others in this movement. And so if you want to know about that when it's available, just go to my website, thankgodrevolution.com, and just, you know, put your name and email address down. I'd also invite you to check out the thing that I just uploaded today on evolutionary spirituality. I think there's a lot of stuff there that you may find useful. So I'd say that's it. But, you know, obviously Connie and I travel. Assuming I survive this cancer, which right now is looking pretty good, we anticipate hitting the road again. We've got retreat homes lined up for some of this year, but we're always looking for people that have a home in a really gorgeous place that are willing to allow us to be there for a couple weeks or longer so that we can use it for a writing retreat or whatever. So, or if you are with an organization and you'd like to invite us to come and speak, again, it's easy from the Thank God Revolution website to invite us to speak. So if you have a home to offer or you'd like us to speak, by all means, let us know, please.
Yeah, great. And also, just to let everybody know, we're going to have Michael's wife, Connie Barlow, on later on in this series, so stay tuned for that. She'll bring a whole – the two of them are joined at the hip and complete mission partners, but they both bring – they each bring – a unique angle to it all as well. Connie's a real scientist, so she'll help us out in some different
ways. She'll also be sharing how this evolutionary spirituality perspective has been firing up young people. She's been doing amazing stuff in terms of educational materials and stuff for kids and programs for kids and stuff. So it's don't miss hers.
Okay, great. All right. Well, Michael, thank you so much. And I know you're going to continue on with us in the Evolutionary Cafe, which is coming up in a few minutes. So for those who carry on with us there, you'll get to hear a bit more from Michael. And but thanks so much for coming on and bringing your heart and your story and your wisdom to us. It's been really fantastic.
Thank you, Craig.
So always a pleasure. Okay. Well, but before I tell you about what's coming up next week, just a few reminders. If you're interested in diving deeper into the conversation, be sure and join our Facebook group where you can participate in discussion forums on any of the topics we discussed today or on any of the other teleseminars. Just go to facebook.com and search for Awakening the Impulse to Evolve, or just click on the link in the email we sent you yesterday, and that will get you there too. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/integralspirit. If you want to learn more about my work, visit integralenlightenment.com. and academyforevolutionaries.com. And if you have any friends that you think might be interested in this series, please forward them one of our emails so they can find out about what we're doing and join us. And if someone sent you this audio or you found it in some far-flung corner of the Internet and you'd like to listen in on the other 18 dialogues in this series, visit evolutionaryspirituality.com. That's evolutionaryspirituality.com. And finally, I want to thank all the partners and sponsors who've made all this possible, including our event partners, Gaia Community and EnlightenNext, and all of our sponsors, The Shift Movie, Women on the Edge of Evolution, Feminine Power, The Integral Incubator, Integrative Spirituality, Next Step Integral, Global Mind Shift, Elevate Films, I Evolve, and Bay Area Integral. And in terms of next week, I want to invite you to tune in at the same time next Thursday for my dialogue with evolutionary cosmologist and all-around remarkable human being, Brian Swim, who's really been one of the major catalysts introducing so many of us to this great evolutionary story that Michael spoke about tonight, I spoke about last week. Brian's really one of the iconic figures in this whole emerging movement, and he's a poet. He's a spontaneous poet. When he speaks about the cosmos, he brings it to life in a way that few people can. So I'm really looking forward to talking with him. The title of that event is Reinventing the World, Creating a New Cosmic Culture. So look forward to seeing you there next week. And now we're going to shift gears and get started on our new virtual evolutionary cafe. The way this works is each week, immediately following the teleseminar, you have an opportunity to come together with a small group of fellow evolutionaries in a facilitated conference call environment to explore the topics discussed on the call. And we're using the Revolutionary New Maestro Conference technology for this, which allows us to break you up into small groups, very much like a workshop, and then offer questions and guided group inquiry. We've been using this on our own courses for a while now, and it's been a really great evolution of technology. So to participate in the cafe, you need to create a personal PIN code. You can find full instructions for how to do that in the email newsletter that we sent you yesterday. And we also, in the email we sent out today, we included a link. So if you want to jump on with us in a few minutes, you could probably get yourself a PIN code and get on that call. That we will start in, I'll just say 5 minutes, we will meet you there. So because we just give everybody time to take the break and get on the call. So we will see you there in a few minutes. Okay, thanks again, everyone. It's been great to be with you and keep evolving. We can unmute the line so everybody can say goodbye now.
Bye.
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 Live long.